This is the Washington Indivisible Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Cox. Reed Saris is a candidate for superintendent of public instruction. He is the founder of Equal Opportunity Schools, a nonprofit that is dedicated to helping students of all backgrounds succeed. And he is the author of the just released book, The Kid Across the Hall and the Fight for Opportunity in Our Schools. Reed Saris, hello. How are you, man?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're very, very excited to talk to you. A lot of people interested in hearing from you. You know, on your website, you note that you are a fourth generation educator, which is absolutely awesome. Tell us a little bit about your experience in the public school classroom.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, all the way back to my great grandfather and my grandmother, my aunt, my mother. And then I've been a teacher. I actually started I was a teaching assistant in middle school for an elementary school summer program that I was a part of all through middle school. And so got started probably by the age of 11 in the classroom, and then did student teaching in college and became a teacher in Beaufort, South Carolina for several years and an administrator. And then most recently, I was teaching in Rainier Beach High School in Seattle.
So you mentioned your work in South Carolina. I know this is in your book and, you know, also stems from the work that you did with Equal Opportunity Schools. Here you talk about what you call the opportunity gap for students, which is distinct from the achievement gap. I know this is personal to you. Talk about how you experience this personally.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. So for me, the challenge of the achievement gap is that it can be blaming kids and blaming teachers. And the opportunity gap really says, why are there these differences? What are the differences in opportunities that we're creating for low-income students, for students of color, for first-generation students? My own best friend growing up and I were sent off on different paths in high school for no particularly good reason. My mom knew the school system inside and out and pointed me in the right direction. And he was a first generation for going to college trying to go to college and do that sort of thing. So his experience was coloring in worksheets in middle school and doing relatively low level work while I got to read great books and debate big issues and write papers and get ready to go to Harvard and all these cool things. And I just, in his words, he spent decades trying to make up for what was lost at that juncture in our lives. And so you could look at his GPA, which at the time was a 1.7, and you could say, oh, geez, you know, Jamie, really, he's an underachiever or a low achiever, or he's a part of this achievement gap. But the reality was he wasn't put into courses that challenged him and engaged him. And so that's why I think a focus on what opportunities are we providing and to whom allows us to really address the systemic inequities in our school system and close those gaps.
Yeah, well, you know, we know that education is not one size fits all. It's, of course, a big challenge to try to, you know, personalize at scale. And you say that you feel our children are not being adequately prepared by our schools for a post-high school future, and that you have a, quote, no cracks approach to putting them on the path to jobs, to college. Talk about this problem as you see it and some of the no cracks solutions that you would try to implement.
Sure, absolutely. I think, you know, we have incredible teachers, we have incredibly talented students working incredibly hard every day, families who want the best for their kids. And the problem comes down to the system. The problem comes down to really having systems that teachers, students, families can rely on. And so when I showed up to my teaching assignment as a long-term sub, they said, you know, it's great that you're teaching these classes. Could you also please help everybody figure out what they want to do after high school and to get into those opportunities? And to me, coming in, the notion that I could figure that out for all of my seniors was just overwhelming. And there were incredible people. So again, this is not an attack on the people whatsoever. Incredible people working on this issue that we got to team up and really work with these kids through the steps of applying to college, figuring out what they wanted to do by way of career, brought in a lot of speakers and these sorts of things. But to me, the notion that you would get to your senior year and you wouldn't have experienced a system that really prepared you for that moment is really challenging. And so other states who do this really well, we talk high school and beyond in our state, but just to me to go in and actually have that visceral experience, which is also reflected in our data about what happens to kids after they graduate in Washington and being really behind compared to other states there, and just saying, you know, can you figure it out? It's not a system that makes sure that every kid gets matched with the opportunities that they want and that they're seeking.
Well, certainly that's the problem. So talk a little bit about this no cracks approach to really solving this problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not somebody who thinks technology is the big solution to education, but in this case, I think it can add a lot of value. I think there are systems like in Massachusetts and otherwise that we could build here. My wife worked in education technology for a little while, and they create journeys to support kids. You know, you think about the old school version of you go in and you take a test and they say, aha, we figured it out. You're meant to string electrical wires. And you say, I'm scared of heights. So how did they come up with that? You know, everybody has those sorts of stories. It's so far off. But in today's world, you know, we have your ability to, you know, guide somebody through radio station choices. What music do you like? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Well, try this. Did you like that one? And so that's the kind of thing that I think could be a backbone so that every kid is engaged at each step of the way. And you say, hey, I loved chemistry class, but I didn't really like history class. Great. We suggest that you try this physics class next semester. We suggest you take a more challenging version of this. And then to collect the information for teachers, students, and families, again, supported by technology so that it's not saying to someone like me or a guidance counselor, go out and figure out every job that exists out there and every career and how it works and how you would get access, every higher ed opportunity. And after you figured out everything, you know, across the state of Washington, come back and guide kids. A platform could help with that. And so it could just then start to say to people, hey, you loved that? Try this internship this summer that's available for you. And that's the kind of thing that other states are building, and that I think we could build here in Washington. And then the role of me or a counselor becomes manageable. The kid comes back and says, it's really down to these two options for me that I really am convinced would both be good, but one of them's far away and one of them's close. Should I stay close to my family? I'm trying to figure that out. And then you have a conversation and you guide a kid through that. So that's the kind of thing I'm thinking where you're engaging each kid, you know, each step of the way, in a more systematic way.
Well, I certainly could have used a program that embraced my love of history and not so much my love of chemistry. I was sort of the opposite of the paradigm that you're talking about there. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about this epidemic of mental health issues that we are seeing
Sure.
Across the country of school-aged children. Particularly, I want to talk about what we're going to do here in Washington. So you cite on
Yeah.
your website that 58% of teenagers in the state struggle with anxiety or depression, and that 10% have been suicidal. These are terrible, terrible figures. Now, you say that there are, quote, affordable solutions that can be locally controlled by parents and communities to quickly address these challenges. It's a big claim. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure, absolutely. I worked with people all over the state and developed a paper with the Children's Alliance we put out last summer. And the paper focuses on sort of four main pieces. And we found these to be the biggest obstacles to accessing care in our state. So the one is, are you seeking care or are people aware that you need care? So for that one, we looked at a program in King County that does some universal screening and supports kids on some basic strategies for dealing with anxiety and depression, which account for the majority of the burden of the mental health disease. So that's one, I think, is to build on some of those things that in King County and elsewhere are working to have universal screening so we're aware when people are in need of care. The second one to me was provider availability. So we talk about, you know, and it's true. You know, if you look at the core model by which we provide care to people today, you have about half of the therapists that are needed for the level of anxiety and depression that exists in our state. But there are places like Tacoma, Educational Service District 113, and others that are doing group-based therapy. And the researchers that we worked with from UW said the evidence is really clear that group-based therapy for adolescents is as effective as individual therapy. It may not be the thing that every individual chooses, but we looked at if you switch 14% of the providers to group-based care, you would close the provider gap. So you wouldn't have these huge wait lists that any parent in today's world looking for care for their kid runs into, you know, where can I find somebody? They're all booked up. So that's one, I think. And then affordability. So Colorado, Hawaii, Los Angeles County, and others have decided that this is an urgent enough priority that they want to provide that care for free for kids. I think we can and should do that here in Washington. And then there's an effectiveness of care and doing evidence-based approaches. So those are the types of things where I think you can turn that into roadmaps where localities can choose how they want to approach it. Some people may want to do telecare or other things. There's also the preventative side we didn't talk about related to social media and smartphones, and some of those pieces. But I think these are doable things. They're affordable. The package that we put together would be $25 million, on a $17 billion a year school budget. So definitely doable if you really get coordinated and bring people together to pick what's going to work for them locally out of those sorts of practices.
So $25 million, that's the affordability aspect, making sure that kids are seeking care, making sure that providers are available. Interesting approach you talk about in Tacoma, using group therapy as a way to sort of increase the numbers of children who'd be accommodated. And then evidence-based, locally controlled by parents. You mentioned a community aspect, but elaborate a little bit on what you mean by locally controlled by parents.
Sure. Just the notion that, when it comes to things like surveying kids, when it comes to things like assigning a kid to a therapist, underage kids, the parents need to be involved with that under the regulations that we have in place. So to me, it's creating options that people can take advantage of and that they can opt out of when it comes to some of these things as well.
You
And
know,
school boards will design it and adopt based on what makes the most sense locally.
I want to talk a little bit about our last election, some of the things that we saw. We saw a big push by groups like Moms for Liberty, running candidates for school boards who advocated for book banning, stood against inclusiveness. Now, we understand that the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction does not dictate curriculum, but the superintendent does set the tone, right, for schools in the state. So what message would you like to see on this from OSPI?
To me, inclusiveness is absolutely essential. Every kid needs to feel safe and like they belong in their school. And that's a non-negotiable, regardless of the kid's background, regardless of any of the hot button political issues like that we talk about, or banning books or, we should promote that every single kid, needs to feel safe, included in their school. And I believe, we're not a state that really. Yes, there's been pushes for this, but our overall values as a state are not really about banning books and censoring things. It's about empowering and trusting educators and communities to make smart decisions about those things. And I think librarians are smart people. I think educators are smart people. And these are professional decisions that we need to lead on, as well as just non-negotiable, making sure every kid feels included and supported, regardless of their background or experience.
I want to ask you about a big subject in education here in the state, and that is funding and funding models in particular. So we know that funding for our schools often falls disproportionately on homeowners in the form of supplemental bonds and levies. And we know also that this can exacerbate the imbalance of funding in our schools, particularly for areas that don't vote for these, presumably because they can't afford them. So in your mind, what needs to change here? I know that you've cited a recently passed capital gains tax as a funding source. What other avenues would you explore?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think we need to continue to make our funding formula more progressive. The numbers that have been talked about, 50th, maybe we moved up to 49th or 48th, in terms of, being the least progressive funding and revenue in the state. And so I think we need to continue to make our funding formula much more progressive. I think we need to look at how we use our resources more effectively. I think some of the challenges around the federal dollars coming in, the legislature did an audit of those, the federal government did an audit of those, and there was mismanagement of those funds, makes it challenging. But my goal would be to say, let's do cool things that solve problems for kids and families, show the legislature that we can make real progress, and then let's talk about a fundamentally, future-looking funding formula that lives up to our values. And to me, that means some significant increases in funding. Yes, I think the capital gains tax is a key part of that, and looking at other ways that that and other things can be expanded to ensure that the tax code is more progressive. But the one of the big things I have my eyes on is we're funding schools with significant portions of low-income students. We're giving those schools about 10% less resources. And this is exacerbating the inequities that we have. Whereas states who do this well, I got to partner with Illinois and Maryland and others who overhauled their funding formulas. They put 30% more resources into schools with high proportions of kids in poverty, with greater levels of need in the classroom in some ways. And so, to me, you have to show what we can do with some of the resources we have and some things that aren't huge ticket, like the mental health approach that we've been talking about. And then you can really have a leadership conversation with the legislature and others about what does the future of the funding formula look like, to live up to our values and really be fair to kids across the state.
I want to talk about the legislature in depth in a moment, but just to clarify, when you say we're 49th, Are you talking about Washington being the 49th most regressive in how we tax, or are you referring to education funding specifically?
Yes, the regressiveness of the taxation. That's my memory. I may not get the number exactly right, but a lot of the conversation around capital gains seemed to be, we used to be at the very bottom and we moved it up a little bit from the bottom.
We have been a very regressive state when it comes to taxation. Yes. We're working very hard in particular and pushing our representatives on this show to really address that. And, you know, related to funding, I think progressives in the state are very concerned about the potential of having somebody in the position of superintendent who is in any way in favor of privatization, right? Or who is influenced by people who are in favor of privatization. So just to be very explicit with you, do you support privatization of our schools at any level? Vouchers, charter schools, so-called academies, anything like that?
I don't support vouchers at all. Obviously, we have a charter law. I've never worked with charters or been a charter advocate, but the role of the superintendent is to serve directly or as a delegate on the charter commission. And so I would see the responsibility there to make sure that those kids get the best education that we can in the context of the law that we have for charter schools. But I'm not an advocate of increasing that or focusing on that as a strategy whatsoever.
You say on your website that you have identified the most impactful and affordable areas where we can invest our educational funds, and they are diverse teacher recruitment, teacher retention, and effective teacher-led professional learning. I was actually having dinner with a teacher last night who teaches in Washington schools, and she responded very favorably to these approaches. But I'll just ask you, given that school districts are the ones who get to decide how to use state money for things like recruitment and retention, what do you see as the challenges of implementing something like this from OSPI?
It's such a good question. I think it's the most important question. Yeah, how is OSPI going to do its work on these issues? And a lot of folks have brought up the fact that our, you know, OSPI does not have a dashboard to go in there and press buttons and pull levers and, you know, transform education around the state. But I think I have the best training to actually make the most of this as an opportunity, because the nonprofit organization I built, working with traditional public school districts all over the country, had zero power over people to force people to do anything. But what we did is we had more than 1,000 school, district, and state leaders bring us in and say, please help us solve these challenges. Because what we did from a leadership standpoint is we brought evidence together, we brought know-how, and we could support people to implement good changes. And so my experience with the superintendents all over the state of Washington and all over the country at this point is they are eager to solve some of these toughest challenges. I go in and meet with folks. Nobody's saying, oh, mental health, I don't give a hoot about that. They're saying, oh, we're dying with this issue here. This issue is crushing our teachers. We don't know what to do. And so to my mind, even though you don't have the power, to your point, districts make a lot of the decisions in our state, you can bring the evidence together and you can say, hey, let's take a look at what works. And this is what we did and tried to model in this Children's Alliance paper. Here's an example within the state of Washington on each of these four areas that's really getting the job done on the mental health front for kids. What would it take to make that happen statewide? What did they do from an implementation standpoint? That's where I've spent most of my career, is that sort of work. And so I think that's where people are eager to make breakthroughs on in the learning gaps, closing opportunity gaps, like they hired us to do with Equal Opportunity Schools, mental health, post-secondary. These superintendents and principals are eager to solve these problems. And if you're a credible leader who knows what you're talking about, they'd be glad to have you help to do that work. And then you can use the bully pulpit to organize the legislature and others to help resource that in more effective ways.
Now, you're talking about the work that you did with Equal Opportunity Schools. Would you be advocating for third-party private nonprofits to come in, say, and do things like what you call effective teacher-led professional learning?
I think that depends on what teachers want. I think that depends on what districts want. I think building it internally works well. I think working with the union works well. In some cases, I think nonprofits and university partners work well. But to my mind, you always start, and this is what we did at Equal Opportunity Schools. We start with, what does every teacher in the building think of this issue? Where are they on it? What do they want to see happen? What are they observing?
So this was, you know, bottom up. This was you were being responsive.
Yes. Yes.
So I mentioned that we were going to come back to the legislature, and I really do want to talk a little bit about this, because it's really one of the most impactful ways that OSPI can work to create change, right, is in pushing for legislation. And a lot of that starts with relationships with members of the legislature. Have you started to develop these relationships?
Yes, absolutely.
Can you talk
And
about that a little bit?
sure. Yeah. So the bulk of my work has been all over the country. And so, even though I'm, born and raised in Washington State, I've done work all over the country. So I don't have the deepest of political relationships locally. I do have deep relationships with the superintendents and the folks implementing, and have begun to develop relationships with legislators and gotten some early endorsements there as well. So continuing to build that, I think, the challenge is that, most of the other folks running in this race who are in leading positions have experience in the legislature. And I don't know that that's translated to the legislative breakthroughs that folks have hoped for, or the confidence in what's going on in the schools, as I mentioned earlier with the audit, the report back that 74% of those funds went to other and we couldn't talk about where they went. So I think a fresh leader with lots of experience with districts, with some initial support among the legislature and who leads based on evidence and progressive values, could really help us to break through and hit a new level with the legislative relationships.
You just mentioned early endorsements. I know that your website currently lists no endorsements. You say on LinkedIn that you've been endorsed by three superintendents currently retired. Who in the legislature has been an early endorser, and also who from the education sector that you can tout at this point?
Sure. Great question. So we should have that up in a matter of days. We're finalizing some of those at the moment. I was the most recent endorsement is a recently retired legislator, Ruth Kagey, who's endorsed us, and a number of others who've said that they would. And I just want to confirm that we can publish that before we put it up. So those will be up in a matter of days. And then we have dozens of educational leaders who are supporting us. The three that we featured are examples of many more, and we'll share those names as well. I've also been lucky to be encouraged and have donations and support from President Obama's Secretary of Education, John King, and others. So happy to share more of those, have mayoral endorsements locally and otherwise. But that's definitely the area that as we talked about with the legislature, that I'm building. I'm an educator by practice, not a politician. So we'll show a lot of educator endorsements and some of these early political endorsements as well.
Well, because you are an educator, not a politician, obviously who you work with, who you consult with matters. So, who are you consulting with both on your campaign, and then who would you plan to consult with, in your job as superintendent?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm very much a bottoms-up sort of person. So I want to always hear from teachers, from students, where they are, what the data says, both directly in a qualitative sense, in surveys, in focus groups. And that to me is where you build and you support le local leaders to make better decisions. Oftentimes they say, oh, well, we're not sure if we're going to address this equity issue. And we'd say, well, 80% of your teachers really think it's important. I say, oh, geez, wow, we can do this because this is where our teachers will want. So very much from there. And then, as I mentioned, all the way up to, senior most federal officials. So I consult broadly and engage with a wide variety of folks. I continue to learn from my students. Yeah, I like working with all sorts of folks. I like working with academics. I like working with teachers union. And I think often when you do that, you find surprisingly that some of the toughest things that people think are going to be big conflicts, people have common goals around. And so that's when you can say, wow, we all want our kids to learn how to read and do math. We all want our kids to feel well and healthy on a mental health front. We all want them to have incredible opportunities when they graduate. Let's come together and talk about the best pathways to do that and build a plan together.
So I want to ask you, you've mentioned your donors. I want to dig a little bit here. So we
Sure.
solicited questions in advance of this discussion, and some Indivisible members have expressed some concern that, per your PDC reporting, a considerable amount of your funding has come from out-of-state donors, and in particular, people working in the tech and consulting sector. So I want to give you a chance to respond to that. How do you respond to that concern?
Sure. I think it's an asset and a necessity to work across sectors and across lines. And what I bring to this race is a local educator who's done work that's really respected nationally. So as I mentioned, equal opportunity schools, I don't have the exact current number, but I think it's over three dozen states that it's active in. So I've built a national organization, and that's where a lot of my relationships are all over the country. So absolutely have support from around the country and locally. And then in the nonprofit sector, a lot of the fundraising does happen with philanthropists. And so that's where I've developed a number of relationships with folks as well who give in support of public schools.
I think
And then
the
most.
concern, if I may just jump in, I think the
Sure,
concern actually
please.
is not in the nonprofit and it's not around the country. It's specifically people in California and people in the Bay Area, and in particular in Silicon Valley.
Yep. Yeah, that's where I went to graduate school. So I have a lot of classmates and things there. Yeah, it's anyone who knows my work, and this is challenging in a political campaign because how do you convey the deeper side of things? But my work is committed, as I mentioned, from the experience with my best friend, with my foster sister, to closing opportunity gaps, to doing that with traditional public schools. I do have some supporters who support things like charter schools. That doesn't mean that I support them. I have friends who believe in me, and we can disagree on some policy matters, and they can still think that we can improve public schools with my leadership. So, yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question.
Just to be very explicit, then, the support that you're receiving financially from people who support charter schools, you in no way see that as influential in terms of, especially on the issue of charter schools.
No, and I'm very transparent with them about my views, and I even put in my book, for folks who know me, again, it goes to the evidence. I don't have it in front of me, but in the back of the book, I do a deep dive in terms of the evidence and what's impactful and what's not. And charter schools are not impactful in terms of improving student outcomes, for one. So it's not something that I think, the evidence stands up against. I've scrutinized that extensively. And then I've criticized a lot of the people who do that research because they actually don't include the impact on traditional public schools when you're taking money from a traditional public school and putting it into a charter school. So I show my work and where my views come from and the data behind them. And I think that's clear to anybody who supports me as well.
Just one final question for you, because I know
Sure.
that this is super important, and we're going to go back to the legislature since that's where so much of the action happens. Given that this is where OSPI can really have an impact, what are two or three pieces of legislation that you would want to push for right away in office?
Sure, that's a great question. So definitely a mental health bill and approach along the lines that we outlined in the Children's Alliance paper, I think is critical. I think we need a funding stabilization measure. So if we follow the per student funding formula, we will have a decline in funding for K-12 automatically as a result of declining enrollments. The suggestion, at least according to the analysis in the Seattle Times, was that we've declined 5% and we're going to decline another 5% in the years ahead. So I think we need to make a commitment at a minimum to stabilize and not decrease the funding as would happen under that formula, to secure increases for inflation and increases in costs. So everywhere I go and folks I talk to, they're laying off teachers, they're shutting down schools. There's talk about having to return some funds potentially to the feds under this audit or other things like that that I heard a little bit about possibilities today. So I think you need to stabilize the funding, absolutely. And then the third one, would probably be let's take up President Biden's recommendations around tutoring and implement those in a strategic way in the near term because it is just too much to ask a teacher to deal with all of the different levels of learning that are coming out of the pandemic and all of the mental health challenges while there's other teachers being laid off. The teacher next door to me had 40 students in a 10th grade class. I was in a classroom the other week that had 52 students in a middle school math class. It's unsustainable. And so we need to stabilize the funding, provide tutoring support, and an evidence-based mental health plan.
There you go. Yeah, mental health, funding stabilization, Biden's tutoring recommendations. So before I let you go, I do know that you mentioned in a recent endorsement meeting that you were a triathlete. I've done some triathlons myself. It's getting to be that season. The sun isn't out today, but it's been out. Are you currently training for anything coming up?
I just get out most every weekend with friends, go run in the foothills here, and running up a mountain is where I let it all sweat out of you and come back refreshed.
Trail running is the absolute best. Couldn't agree more.
Yes.
Reed Saras, this has been such a pleasure. How can people get in touch with your campaign?
Sure. So we're at www.reed4waschools.com is the best way to reach us.
Excellent. Very good. And we'll have that for folks in the show notes. Reed Saras, thank you so much for taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
And that'll do it for this week. The executive producer of the show is Kat Pipkin. If you would like to see a video version of this podcast, head to facebook.com/indivisiblepodcast. The email address for the show is indivisiblepodcast@gmail.com. Special thanks to Lori Colwell. And as always, my thanks to you for listening. I'm Stephen Cox, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.